Good evening. I'm Jeff Bennett. Tonight on PBS News Weekend, as a series of devastating wildfires continue to burn throughout New Mexico, we take a look at the role of climate change. Then a new documentary focuses on often overlooked stories of people fighting against authoritarian governments around the world. And the power of resilience, the incredible story of one woman who started running marathons after she lost her leg to cancer.
And there's so many things that you get told, you can't do this, you can't do that. And running was one of those things. So it was more of a stubbornness inside me that I'm like, you know what, I want to give it a shot.
Those stories and the day's headlines on tonight's PBS News Weekend. It is good to be with you. We begin tonight with New Mexico, where thousands of firefighters are battling a colossal wildfire, now the largest in state history. Part of the blaze was caused by spot fires from a prescribed or intentional burn, but it's also fueled by abnormally warm, windy, and dry weather. The fire has destroyed hundreds of buildings and forced thousands of evacuations. A historic drought, the worst in over a millennium, coupled with climate change, has led to longer and more destructive wildfires across the West. And this is all happening as rising housing prices are pushing people further into fire-prone areas at the edges of wildlands. For more on this, I spoke with Michael Mann. He's a professor of atmospheric science at Penn State University and the author of The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Planet. We started by talking about what accounts for the scale of the New Mexico wildfire.
This is a tragedy that we're seeing play out. You know, it doesn't really matter much what starts these fires, whether it's a prescribed burn, whether it's a lightning strike. What determines the scale, how fast they spread, how wide they spread, how hot they burn, how much damage they do, ultimately is a function of how much fuel there is, how much sort of dry wood and other material that's available to catch on fire. And that is a function of how dry the climate is. So we are seeing record levels of drought over a large part of the western U.S. year after year. Right now, a substantial part of the western U.S. is in either extreme or exceptional drought. So you take that extreme drought, you combine it with that heat, the warming that we're seeing, and you get these unprecedented wildfires that we've seen play out in California, Colorado, Arizona, New Mexico, Oregon, Washington, parts of Canada in recent years. It's not rocket science. You combine the heat and the drought, you get these sorts of devastating wildfires.
Well, what should be done about it, given the exceptional drought across parts of the western U.S.?
Well, you know, ultimately, the only way to prevent all of this from getting worse, from it getting drier and hotter and seeing even more widespread, even more destructive and more deadly wildfires, is to solve the problem, at its core, which is our ongoing burning of fossil fuels and the increased carbon pollution in the atmosphere that is warming up the climate. There are things that we can do to try to increase our resilience, move away from especially, wildfire-prone regions, taking adaptive measures to try to cope with the increased risk that we're now seeing. But ultimately, we are stuck with that. We are stuck with these levels of elevated risk that we're going to have to deal with. And if we don't stop warming up the planet through carbon pollution, it will get worse and worse.
I'm struck by the connection between housing policy and climate policy. Given that housing is so unaffordable across so many parts of the country, to include the West, you have people moving further and further out into these wildfire zones. How should we rethink housing policy in ways that are sort of climate responsible?
As many as 1,000 homes are likely to be lost in this wildfire. We need to ultimately move away from those increasingly risk-prone areas, and we need, policies that incentivize that. Ultimately, folks who live in these sorts of regions are going to find it more and more difficult to get insurance, to get home insurance. And as I've said before, uninsurability is sort of the first step along that path to uninhabitability. And that's what we're coping with now.
Given the vast amount of writing and research you've done on this topic, how do you guard against climate defeatism, this sense that this problem is so vast, it's so complicated? It oftentimes seems like there's not a whole lot that we can do about it. How do you advise people against that?
So there is something that we can do. We can get off fossil fuels. And the science here, in a sense, is encouraging. The science over the last decade or so has shown us that if we stop putting carbon pollution into the atmosphere, if we stop, you know, with these ongoing carbon emissions, then the warming stabilizes fairly quickly. So there is an immediate and direct impact of our efforts to decarbonize. We can prevent warming from crossing certain catastrophic thresholds, like 1.5 degrees Celsius, 3 degrees Fahrenheit warming, where we will start to see some of the worst impacts of climate change. There's still time to do that, but you know, there is agency. We can still do it, but there is urgency. We have to reduce global carbon emissions by 50% within the next decade if we are to keep warming below that catastrophic level. And that's going to require policy. That's going to require politicians who are willing to support climate-friendly policies. And that means us voting for those politicians who will act on our behalf rather than acting as rubber stamps for polluters.
Agency and urgency. Michael Mann, thanks again for your time and for your insights. We appreciate it.
Thank you. Always a pleasure, Jeff.
And now to today's headlines. President Biden is in Tokyo after wrapping up a 3-day visit to Seoul. Before leaving, the president thanked U.S. and South Korean troops stationed at Osan Air Base, and he toured the Air Operations Center, where the military monitors and defends against threats from regional adversaries, namely North Korea. Asked by a reporter if he had a message for North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, President Biden responded by simply saying hello. It underscores the administration's low-key approach to the unresolved tensions there. The president also touched on the growing concern about a rare but spreading virus, monkeypox.
Something that everybody should be concerned about. We're working on it hard, figure out what we do and what vaccine, if any, may be available for it. But it is a concern in the sense that if it were to spread, it's consequential.
A case of monkeypox has been confirmed in Massachusetts as well as a likely case in New York. The CDC says it's monitoring a handful of other cases in the U.S. And the president of Poland spoke defiantly before Ukrainian parliament during a visit to Kyiv today. It was the first such speech by any foreign leader since the Russian invasion began months ago. Meantime, just a day after President Biden signed that massive $40 billion aid package for Ukraine, Russian airstrikes have continued in the eastern Donbass region and decimated thousands of educational institutions and cultural sites, according to Ukrainian President Zelensky. In Pennsylvania, Lieutenant Governor John Fetterman was released from the hospital today after suffering a stroke more than a week ago. Fetterman is the Democratic nominee for the U.S. Senate seat in Pennsylvania. This past week, he voted absentee, and he won his primary from his hospital room. Meantime, the baby formula scarcity in this country got a much-needed resupply today. A military cargo plane carrying nearly 40 tons of Nestle baby formula from Switzerland arrived earlier in Indiana. Officials say the formula supply will be sent to hospitals, pharmacies, and doctors' offices with the greatest need. And Jif is recalling a number of its peanut butter products over concerns of a salmonella outbreak. 14 people have reported illnesses, and 2 cases have resulted in hospitalizations. That's according to the CDC. The full list of Jif's recalled products is available on the FDA's website. And Australian swimmer and Olympic gold medalist Ariane Titmus added one more to her record book finishes today, breaking the world record in the women's 400-meter freestyle. Her finish bested American Katie Ledecky's prior world record finish by 0.06 of a second. And still to come on PBS News Weekend, a new documentary explores the often forgotten wars happening around the world and how a cancer survivor is defying odds, running marathons, and breaking records.
This is PBS News Weekend from WETA Studios in Washington, home of the PBS NewsHour, weeknights on PBS.
More than 6 million Ukrainians have fled their country since Russia's invasion in February. While most of those refugees made their way to neighboring European countries, some are now living in the U.S. PBS Wisconsin's Marissa Wojcik spoke with one woman about her difficult decision to leave.
Varya Druzhina is like any other six-year-old girl. Every morning, she gets ready for school with the help of her parents. Her mom is there to pack her backpack, but her dad has to check in from thousands of miles away. Varya has only had this odd routine for nearly 3 months, ever since she and her mother escaped Ukraine. They came to Madison, Wisconsin, to stay with friends. Her mother, Anya Mikhailova, video calls her husband, Sasha, Varya's father, back in Ukraine every morning.
So beautiful kiss.
And same as if he were here with them. Accompanies Varya and Anya on the half-mile walk to school.
I had perfect life. I had everything. I have family. I have husband. I have perfect, best daughter.
Have a good day, kiddo.
I couldn't accept this new reality. The Russian army came. It was forced decision. And we can't decide by ourselves what we will do, where we will live, how we will live. They decided for us. My husband, he asked every day, you should leave, please, you should leave. I saw a picture of a dead girl on internet, and she was the same age like my Varya. And I thought it could be my kid too.
They made it to the US on March 3rd. But more than anything, Anya wants to return home.
I'm here only because of Varya. I think if I didn't have Varya, I would be in Ukraine with my husband, with all my family.
But she's also seeing things through her young daughter's eyes.
She said, yes, I miss home, but I want to live too, to have real life.
Anya's Russian relatives refuse to believe the reality of the war.
I have relatives in Russia, in Rostov, and they didn't believe. They didn't believe me. I sent pictures from my apartment. When it will touch them personally, I think they will wake up.
Without knowing the future, Anya endures.
We need to be strong. We will win. Everything will be okay. We rebuild everything. Yeah.
For PBS News Weekend, I'm Marissa Wojcik in Madison, Wisconsin.
A new documentary aims to draw attention to the wars, fighting, and atrocities happening around the world that are often undercovered or all entirely forgotten. Correspondent Ali Rogan sat down with French philosopher, journalist, and author Bernard-Henri Lévy to discuss his new film.
Bernard-Henri Lévy, thank you so much for joining us. This film and the book that accompanies it are based on your travels in late 2019, well into 2020. To some of the most dangerous places around the world. Why did you take this on?
Because I wanted to meet ladies and gentlemen who fight Putin, Erdogan, Iran, China, and Islamic Caliphate. This is the topic of this movie. Those who fight these five authoritarian regimes or groups threatening democracy all over the world. I felt that my duty, my task as a public intellectual was to go there to bear testimony on what is happening there the carnage and the resistance, which is confronting the carnage and the massacres.
And of course, each of these countries is unique. They have their own characteristics. But what is your sense of what the people there want outside observers to understand about the conditions in which they are living?
The people I met can be in Bangladesh, in Kurdistan, in Donbass, Ukraine. What they want is to live normally, like us, in democracy, in a state of transparency, without, in the freedom, without these authoritarian boots on their head and sometimes on their body. This is what they want, to raise their families, to rule their house, to rule their life in a normal and liberal way.
In Bangladesh, there are a group of women who are known as national heroines for what they endured. Can you tell me about what they went through to earn, essentially, that title?
50 years ago, at the moment of the liberation of Bangladesh from Pakistani rule, the Pakistani soldiers used rape as a weapon of war. They raped ladies on large scale. And of course, 9 months after that, when the country was freed, they gave birth to babies. And as often in traditional countries, the first reaction was to damn them, to curse them, to ban them from the society and sometimes their families. And there was in Bangladesh a great leader named Mujibur Rahman, whom I knew well. And Mujibur Rahman took the great decision to name these ladies who had been raped and who were giving birth to those babies, not cursed ladies, but Birangona, heroines of the nation. And in the movie, 50 years after, I see them again. And I meet again these young teenagers who are now my age, of course, who have changed, but I see in their eyes the same magnificent light of spirit, of hope, and of resistance. 50 years after, in a way, they did not change.
You had a lot of dark moments throughout your journeys, but I know that you also observed things that gave you hope. What are the things that most gave you hope about the places and the people that you visited?
The incredible dignity of the victims whom I film. The Christians of Nigeria facing Boko Haram and facing the Fulani militias. They keep standing on their feet and on their values. The Kurds of Syria and of Iraq, of KRG, same. They keep resisting with a dignity which is an example for the rest of the world. So this dignity of the victims gives me hope in darkness.
The film and the book by the same name is The Will to See. Bernard-Henri Lévy, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Ali. Thank you.
Finally tonight, our weekend spotlight with amputee marathon runner Jackie Hunt Burisma. I spoke to her about how she's breaking barriers and challenging misconceptions about athletes with disabilities.
South African-born runner Jackie Hunt Burisma, who lost her leg to cancer, recently ran her way into the record books, completing a staggering 104 marathons in as many days.
What drove you to set a new record?
I thought this would be just such a great way to kind of show everyone, to kind of get out of your comfort zones and that you can do hard things.
Starting in mid-January, the 46-year-old mother of two ran 26.2 miles each day, sometimes in official marathons, but usually on dirt trails in Phoenix, where she now lives, and even on her own treadmill.
How did you do it? I mean, people who run marathons, they might run one marathon a year. To run 104 consecutive marathons is unthinkable for a lot of people.
When I started with it, to be honest, I wasn't sure, and especially because I run with a prosthetic, I wasn't sure if I'd actually make it even to 30, because I was like, well, this is going to be quite interesting to see how does my body hold up, how does my blade hold up. There were so many factors to kind of think about. And so when I did hit 104, the first thing I thought to myself is like, how did I do that? I can't believe I actually did it.
In 2002, Jackie was diagnosed with Ewing sarcoma, a rare type of bone cancer. Within weeks, doctors amputated her leg to save her life. She was only 26 years old.
What factors go into running as an amputee?
There's so many, like your body is working at least about 25% harder than if you had your regular legs. And then it's also, you have this prosthetic strapped to your residue limb, your stump, as I call it. And that just, there's so much friction there. You're more prone to blistering. There's a whole bunch of rubbing going on. And to be honest, it actually hurts. Everything's just working a lot harder to kind of control and just to make sure that you're kind of running in sync.
Did you ever think about quitting?
I did. At marathon number 50, I actually got to marathon 50 and I was like, you know what? 50 is a good distance. I think I'm done now. And it was the weirdest thing because I was feeling like physically I was fine. It was just my mind that was like trying to convince me, you know what, you're fine. 50's fine. It's like, it's a good distance. My kids have always been like, they check on me every day. And they're like, which number are you on today, mommy? And when they get back from school, they're like, are you done? Have you finished it? So I kind of had that in my head. And I was like, okay, I cannot quit this thing. I need to get, because they knew I was going for the 100. So I just kept moving.
People might think that with a running streak like yours that you've been running your entire life. But as I understand it, you didn't even pick this up until you had your leg amputated. Tell me more about that.
That's correct. I was the kind of person, I thought runners were crazy. And I thought, why would you do that? And it's weird. And it's like, it's when you lose something, like you lose your limb, and it's like you're kind of put in a box that everyone thinks now, well, now you're an amputee, you're disabled. And to me, that frustrated me. And there's so many things you get told, you can't do this, you can't do that. And running was one of those things. So it was more of a stubbornness inside me that I'm like, you know what? I want to give it a shot. I want to try it and see what happens. And that's kind of how I got into running. I've been running for 6 years now, so it's just been phenomenal.
Long distance running can be as much of a mental challenge as it is a test of physical fitness. How do you build up that mental toughness to be able to do what you've done?
What I often do is when I'm struggling is I'll just tell myself, just get to the next mile. Just kind of just get to your mile. And then once you get to there, you kind of celebrate that. And you're like, you know what? I've just done a mile. That's fantastic. And you kind of get to the next. And that way you kind of trick your mind a little bit. And it's like, you like, eventually when you're done, you're like, oh, I've actually done that. I can do hard things.
You said before you started running that you thought marathon runners were crazy. What do you say to people who might say that your story is inspiring, but still running 104 marathons in a row is a little excessive? And they might wonder, are you a little crazy to do it?
I've been told I am crazy. I probably wouldn't recommend doing 104 marathons in 104 days because it is a little bit extreme. But I would say is, don't be scared to push your limits because I truly, you will surprise yourself. I mean, going into this, I thought, oh, am I actually going to be able to do this? And it's like you put yourself out there and you kind of take risks and you're like, oh, what happens if I fail? And I just feel like you are capable of so much more. You just need to try.
You've had a lot of time to yourself running, I guess, thousands of miles by now. How has this long distance running changed you? What have you learned about yourself?
I've learned that I can be really tough. It's definitely improved my mental strength. And now I know I can do anything that I just need to try.
Jackie Hunt-Burresma, thanks so much for your time. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And next up for Jackie, the Moab. That's a grueling 240-mile race in Utah this fall. She's incredible. And that is PBS News Weekend for tonight. I'm Jeff Bennett. Join us online and again here tomorrow evening. For all of us at PBS News Weekend, thanks for spending part of your Sunday with us.